Okay. So, a few more questions from my earlier faculty before you start to meet. So, ask me some questions, or we'll go to more detail. Either way, we'll go to more detail, but never mind. Yeah. We all here? You know, if you don't have the thought, I will. Can't hear. Good, go. Give me that. I can't hear but see the person behind you. Can you move your chair to the person behind you? Move around so I can see you. I like to see you all. There we go. Go down. Let's say Emil's example of the mouse. He stands on the mouse and kills it, but he doesn't know he's killing it, and therefore there's no intention and no motivation. So that example, so what's your question?
So it still feels like a bad thing.
So it feels like a bad thing. Let's analyse it, shall we? Shall we analyse that? We need to analyse, don't we? In other words, it's right a being got killed, isn't it? It's true, but it's not happy, is it?
No.
But if we're trying to locate, if we're trying to take this view of karma, which is what minds do, and that what minds do determines the result, then if there's nothing in the mind, then how can there be a result in your mind? The mouse is dead. Yeah, that's bad. The poor mummy mouse and daddy mouse will be sad. That's awful. But we're looking at the person who did the action. So if you walk past a homeless person and there's no thought to give any money, but $20 drops out of your pocket, the homeless person's really happy, right? They get happy. But how can you say that you create any virtue of generosity? How could you say that? It is a good action, but there's no responsibility, but there's no involvement by you of giving that $20. Would you agree with that? But it is a good action, isn't it? The person's happy. That's the part that's good, the person gets $20. And the mouse dead, that's the sad part. But you can't say that you have any responsibility in either one of those actions. It's a very technical thing, we've got to get past the emotional part. You get my point? Do you see the point?
Yep.
That's the thing to think about. It doesn't mean you get away, oh good, I got away with that. That's not the point. It's not the point, because karma is a very personal process. That whatever we put into our mind is what brings our results. And whatever results we have in our life is the fruit of what we put in our mind. You see the point? It's quite kind of clinical way to look at it. Do you get the point? So let's think about it. It's a really good one. It's a crucial point. Yeah.
I really like what you said about even if it's unconscious. I will kill the mosquito.
Yeah, that's right. So let's look at that action. Because that's what we would say, oh, I wasn't aware I was doing it. But this is where, if we look into the Buddhist view, that really it goes to really subtle levels. If we can imagine it's true that we come programmed into this life with most of what we think and do and say, what we call instinct, that's from past doing it. There's not a single thing that you would do either instinctively that you haven't done so often that literally now it's second nature. So, you know, because we're so familiar with killing a mosquito and not valuing a mosquito, if you are that kind of person, then even as I'm talking to you being loving and kind, I feel the tickle. Instantaneously, I recognise the mosquito there. Second, I have the intention of my program. Third, aversion. How dare a mosquito take my precious blood? Three, do it. Four, even the second without even thinking. That's a complete action of killing the mosquito. But, and why it feels like less serious is because it's so habitual. It's an even way that's heavier karma. In the same way that if you're spontaneously generous and you don't even notice it, that's more powerful virtue because your mind is more deeply ingrained with virtue. You see my point? That's the point. And that's where we look into animals. This is where it was a big shock to the West. Buddhist view about the mind and karma refers not just to humans, but to all living beings. It's his analysis, okay? So then you think, I was thinking of this particular kind of monkey. Oh, it's a chimp or something. I can't remember which one. I don't know the difference. One of these families of beings, you know. It comes out of its mummy's womb, and it turns around and has sex with mummy. And then with daddy, and then with auntie, and uncle, and grandpa, grandpa. In other words, it's got a really strong tendency of attachment to sexual contact. So, of course, the description of animalism is huge in our culture. All about the animal instincts. You know, while tracking it back to all this, the Buddhist view is karma, it's the mind of that being, due to strong habit. How come a human being comes into this life? I mean, this tiny child has sexual things and, I mean, my friend Panos in Greece, he's a Buddhist, he's old now, but he's a little boy, 6 years old, walking down the street in Athens with his Greek Orthodox mummy, and he sees a poster, a half-naked lady in the cinema. Mummy, why is my pizza standing up? His little voice pipes up. The mummy's mortified because he's rude as lady, and the cinema lady cracked a joke about being a lady killer in the future. Well, this is, we're so radically different. All the physical things are there, of course, but that's driven by his mind. And so in the Vajrayana system, these very sophisticated explanations of the relationship between the subtler physical energies and the mind, very different model, like in Tibetan medical system, very, very different, where there's this intimate relationship between the mind and the different subtle physical energies, like the wind energies. That's because it's completely programmed with attachment to female shapes. It's programmed in his mind. That's what we mean by instinct. So we just think it comes from the physical. The Buddha says it comes from past practice. Why my friend Daichen, her little boy, 3 years old, taking the lice out of his head, and he's in tears of compassion for the lice. Mommy, mommy, what don't hurt them? It's their home. He did everything he could. She hadn't taught him this. In the same way that Paros' mummy had to give him sex education, it's instinctive, both of them, from their past parents. That's the Buddha's explanation. The materialist one is you get it from mummy daddy, and then of course if you're like Hitler or Mother Teresa, we can't work out how come you like mummy daddy, because you're clearly not like mummy daddy, but put that in the too hard basket. So all I'm doing is giving you the Buddhist explanation that we track the mind as a central thing, it's not physical, it comes from before, and we come from the side of program. We meet sentient beings who we've met before, if they harm us, we've harmed them before, and if they're kind to us. But this is the interesting point. I tell you, we spend the rest of the weekend just on this. Everyone that's in this room, I think, can think of some really bad things that have happened to us. And we know some people who really bad things have happened to us. We can think that. But if we give a list, a very simple list, of all the good things since we were born, but I think we don't pay attention to the good things. I think we tend to take them for granted. Well, my mother's supposed to be kind to me. What do you mean it's good that she fed me? Well, of course she fed me. It's her job, we will say. But in a way, that's real hubris. If you really understood the effect, first of all, again, every single thing, every moment by moment, not just occasionally, but every moment of everything that occurs to us, your mother looks at you and is kind to you. That moment of kindness is the fruit of your past kindness. That moment of generosity, moment by moment, there must be 1,000 things a day your mother does to you when you're a baby, but we never think of that. It's only when she whacks you that we remember the whack and think, how dare my mother do that to me, I don't deserve it. And then we paint the whole of mummy with that one whack and think she's a monster. That's what we do. But we never think, oh my God, all the good things. The fact that, the Buddha would say, that the experience is similar to the cause, for example, of the third chakra karma, of past generosity, is that you're born into a place where you can get food. Look at the humans on this planet who can't even get a bowl of rice. This is so different from our view, it was hard to hear it. Everything that's happened to us, that we're born into a family, we have a decent mummy, decent daddy, decent house, decent this, food, money, education, a bicycle to ride. So you smile at someone, they smile back at you instead of raping you, But occasionally the rape happens, remember that one, but not all the other good things. For some reason, it's fascinating. Wrote a list of all the good things that have happened to you in your life. Not just thinking the good thing about $1 million. No, every tiny good thing. A person kind to you. You go to the bank, they give you credit. You get a job. A person smiles. A person believes your words. These are all the fruit of your past virtue. It's a shocking concept. It takes a while to process. But it's only the bad things we remember. It's very astonishing. In other words, I've never yet had a question like this. You mean that beautiful little boy who's got a beautiful mummy and good siblings and good education and money in the bank and a garden to run around in and a football to play with and intelligent and kind and healthy? You mean he deserves it? No one ever asked that. Do you get my point here? Yes, he does. He created every tiny bit of that child. Then the point is the karma, so I'm seeing myself, when you can gradually take on board this philosophy, it doesn't change overnight, it has to argue with all the prevailing philosophies in my head that are so instinctive, and that's my decision to take on board Buddha's view in a very coherent, as well as I can, a very proactive way, not just, oh, yeah, I believe in karma, that's useless. But a way so I can understand it to some degree, so I can use it to interpret my life, that's how you practice it. That's how you practice botany. You apply it. Better believe in it. That's the difference. then it really becomes a rich, rich way to reinterpret your whole bloody life and then to reinterpret the whole world. It's another philosophical view of the universe, you know. And that's up to us what we use. It's up to us what view we take. We can make up your own. No one's saying you can't. You're the boss. What if I'm not reinventing the wheel? I'm happy to see if a dude who's done the work. I'm happy to buy into his view and see if he's right and then apply it and get the results, you know. And that means taking responsibility for all the good things. Instead of this hubris of, well, I deserve good, give me more, please. I don't care the cause. But the bad is very... I mean, if you analyse it logically, there's no rationale to why we would assume we deserve good, but don't deserve bad. It's just, there's no logic to that. There's not a fraction of logic. But we never question that assumption. For me, I find that really fascinating. We never question it. On what basis do you decide you deserve good and don't deserve bad? You want the good and you want the bad. Yes, I agree. That's different. We can use them. We can play them. It's very fascinating.
Rabina, there's that equation in education that if you give children 10 negative, 10 positive inputs, if you give them one negative, it'll be equal to 10.
There you go. And I think that what that points to, we're going to go into this more deeply, is the irony of ego, that we're addicted to the negativity in our own mind. I mean, you look at all our chaotic thoughts. We're going to go to this too. This is when we start talking about the mind in more detail, not karma. That our mind is chaotic, naturally.
Mm.
Because we haven't controlled it in our culture, we don't think we can. That's what Buddha's genius is. We have these techniques that we can learn to harness this energy. It's an advanced practice. You've got to work very hard at it, getting a single point of concentration. Amazing, even some semblance of it. But the thing is, there's millions of thoughts in there, right? They're thoughts, basically. But they're running out of control, aren't they? Like a big bunch of unedited chaos, you know, inside there, underneath, raging on. So, when we can hear those thoughts, when they come to the surface more, when they become more emotional, it's usually the negative ones. Always, I'm no good, I'm not good enough, I'm not this, I'm that, I can't do it, I'm guilty, I'm ashamed, it's bad, I must have something wrong. It's always tending towards the negative. So that's the bitter irony of ego, the way Buddha talks, that they're the ones that loom large for us. And they're the ones we believe. You know, I can tell you 10 times you're a lovely person. You want me to say it again, but you really don't believe it. One time I say you're not nice, you'll run like a magnet and you'll believe it. Yes. All that proves is what we feel ourselves already. So, but the point is, part of what practice, and we're going to go into it more, is we have to learn to become more familiar with our thoughts, identify them in this very distinct way the Buddha describes, which we'll talk about, and then learn to proactively develop the positive thoughts. We can think any damn thoughts we like, it's up to us, it's my mind, you know. But because the ones that are negative are more habitual, even though our good ones are habitual too, the fact that we're sitting here now not killing each other is pretty amazing. Or not to mention not eating each other for breakfast. If we were lions, we'd all be dead. One would be the end result. One would be over, having eaten everybody else for breakfast. So unfortunately, we must have reasonable instincts. That's from past practice of bloody virtue. It's amazing. Understand?
Yeah.
We don't pay attention to it. We just take it for granted. We'll go to the mind. Now it has to be the time, I'd say. Let's do that. Let's switch from karma to the mind. Although the mind creates karma, then that's why we're going to go to the mind, so you know what karma creates. It's very technical, you know. It's a highly technical, sophisticated explanation, but of course it's a big ask to start to listen to it. You've never heard it before, and to give it a possibility, to take it as I want it, you know. It's very fascinating. So, okay. The Buddha's view of the mind. There's two, like I said before, there's the epistemological model, which is utterly fascinating. Scientists would be blissed out to study the way mind functions. But to do that, they'd have to first posit the possibility that they're not describing the brain. So that would be quite difficult for them. Because we can't posit anything else but the brain. The Buddha's describing the cognitive process itself, which is necessarily internal. So these genius yogis meditating before the Buddha, from whom Buddha got these views, and of course he's got his own variation of them, which is still existing right now today. Any word I'm telling you in this room has come directly from studying the Buddha's view. I haven't made this stuff up. All this knowledge has come from internalized, from mapping the mind internally. This concept does not exist in our psychology and science, because we're externally oriented. It's okay, nothing wrong. So it's puzzling to us when we hear that. What do you mean internally mapped? Well, that's the level to which we can develop, such sophisticated level to which we can develop this amazing mind of ours, to be clear, crystal clear, and internally be able to internally conscious. And these, take these words literally, please, not in any cosmic vague way. You know? So, okay, the epistemological model is already very telling. Describes the way consciousness functions. So we basically have two ways of cognizing phenomena. Conceptual, which is the level we function day to day. That's it. And that's curious, that includes intellectual, emotional. This is conceptual thinking. You're going to be very surprised to hear that, but I'll explain. And when we get this, we really get Buddhist psychology. Even the most subtle levels. We've got the vast level of conceptuality, which is kind of all based on millions of thoughts deep in our bones that we don't pay attention to until they come roaring to the surface as emotion. Then we notice them. So there's the conceptuality. Then the other way the mind functions, which is fairly evident, is sensory. So the sensory consciousnesses, and that's how they sort of describe, so we've got five sensory consciousnesses, have we not? So remember the word consciousness and mind in Buddhism is synonymous. And they're referring to the cognitive process itself, which is by definition not physical. So to really spell it out, my I consciousness is that part of my mind, not physical, that functions through the medium of the eyeball and the nerves and all the bits and pieces, all working beautifully together, so that I can have a cognition of the colour blue, let's say. Ear consciousness is that part of my mind that functions through the ear and the bits and the drum and all the bits working nicely, that can cognize sound. And so then basically, in our culture, as long as you put it, we make the body the boss. We think everything is physical. We just give enormous power to our sensory experiences. In fact, we judge all our senses, all our experiences and happiness and suffering based upon the senses. So it plays a massive role in our lives. And Buddha would say we grotesquely over-exaggerate the role of the senses. And this is a massively important point. So this is the telling point. You know, I might say to you, oh, that's a pretty tough, right? So we would all naturally deduce that as you see my head go here, my eyes look at that, my eye consciousness is cognizing a pretty cup. Who would deduce that without question? Well, it's way more subtle than that. It's way more nuanced. In fact, the eye consciousness, in fact, to the Buddha, the senses are really profoundly limited in their capacity for cognition. There's certain levels in which they can cognize certain things, but essentially, the objects of eye consciousness, the objects of ear consciousness. Consciousness, by definition, cognizes something. Always the subject, which is mind, how they talk, and then object. So eye consciousness can cognize shape and colour. That's its capacity. It can be more, but here, keep it really simple. So the logical question has to be, what part of my mind is cognizing a pretty cup? Mm. It's logical, isn't it, to ask that question? Well, that's my mental consciousness. Tibetan point here. That's where the workshop is. For the Buddha, that's where every millisecond of anything I've ever experienced since beginning this time has been stored, my memories. That's where from what I can pluck out of my memory based on my own taste, this life, what I decide is good, bad art, lovely this, all the memories, all the concepts, all the thoughts, all the stories, all the opinions, all the viewpoints, that's conceptual consciousness. That's conceptuality. That's where we live. So that is a pretty cup, is a conceptual story. It's a series of thoughts. What a pretty cup. That means my eye consciousness sees that shape and colour, and then quicker than Google, and this is really true, quicker than Google, because I've programmed myself, I don't have to go, oh, what's that, and look up Google, you know, handle, oh, it's called a cup. No, I've not remembered yet. Right there, that millisecond I know it's a cup, that millisecond I can cognize and pick up from here my memory, all the bits and pieces I like, this, that's a tulip, that's something I like, the array, blah, the shape, and this, whatever, that's my opinions. So what goes on in our mental consciousness as far as Buddhist concerned is a series of opinions, viewpoints, and this is now the psychological model. Those viewpoints, those opinions, those emotions, those concepts, you name it, they are divided into three categories. This is the psychological model. There are those that are neurotic, ridiculous, distorted, exaggerated, based in fear, ego-based, you name it. miserable and happy, and they're called attachment, anger, anxiety, jealousy, low self-esteem. Simple terms. Don't go to your therapist and get some fancy thing like ADHD, DDID, and God Almighty knows what. Buddha keeps it simple. They're states of mind, and they're rooted in big conceptual stories, way deep down. And the stronger we feel them at the emotional level, the more instinctive they are, which means the more we practice them. That's all. Like that little boy, 3 years old, in tears of compassion for the life in his own head. Come on, you can't pretend that. So we have to unpack and unravel the mind. That's Buddha's expertise. And this approach, with respect to our materialist model, does not exist. So the Buddha's approach is unbelievably direct. To be our own therapist, so I'm trying to unravel the contents. And of course it's not easy because we have massively powerful minds. We've got talk about 1,000 thoughts a second, but Western psychology says that, or Buddha agrees. And we know most of it's chaos. And it's really hard to harness it. I go berserk sometimes, it's really true. But as Amiyeti says, we don't have any energy, there's nothing to transform. So be happy about your berserk mind. I'm happy about my berserk mind. You can see I'm berserk. Look at my energy. I haven't calmed down in 42, in 73 years, I haven't calmed down. You can see. I'm probably speedier than I was when I was younger. I say this as a joke, but not just to be so arrogant, but to point out that we've got this cliche, revolting idea of what being a Buddhist is. Walk slowly, be mindful, eat your food slowly. I mean, excuse me. That's being a Buddhist, I fail 100%. And that's being a Buddhist, the Dalai Lama fails. Nobody can believe how fast he talks, you know? He's excited and enthusiastic. He's powerful, he's charismatic. So we really have these grotesque misconceptions about what Buddha said about the mind. We really, really do. It's just so embarrassing, you know? Remember somebody saw Chasing Buddha, that movie my nephew made, Annie L. Not Justin. It was a story about me, what did I say? He came on to prison and everything in America and everything. And a Tibetan who saw it, he said, oh yes, a really good film. He said, it's a film for hopeless cases. And I'm glad to be an example for hopeless cases. I thought, that's good, I'll have that to do that. Hopeless cases, we heroes as well. So the point about the mind, okay, the psychological model. Buddha divided all the contents into three categories. And this seems just deceptively simple. It seems moralistic and deceptively simple because we make it unbelievably complex in the modern psychology, with respect. You've got the neurotic, deluded, eye-based, miserable, unhappy, constricted, paranoid, deluded, all these white rubbish ones, and I'll be more precise in a minute. Second, you've got the positive ones. Come on. Intelligence, kindness, compassion, empathy, ability to think, put two and two together, all the marvellous parts of our mind that are there and vivid, but we don't pay attention to, of course. Hardly at all. For me, I use the analogy, well, they're all my roommates. There are these endless thousands of these roommates, and it's a really nice analogy. But mostly, you see, I'm bad, it's no good, I can't do this, I'm unhappy, it's not satisfied, I'm this is angry, he's horrible, I'm dissatisfied, I'm annoyed, I'm irritated, my knee's hurting. They're running the show, don't you think? They're the ones that are running the house. They're loud and shouting loud. So we can't hear all the good ones. They're hiding under the bed in the wardrobe. They don't come out. We've got to start bringing them out. And I'm serious in these simple analogies. And the irony of ego is, these are the voices of ego, basically, the way Buddha's describing it. So this is where we get to the end result, where the sun gets. Sun implies this stuff, he says, has found, this stuff is, as they say, adventitious. It is not integral to who we are. It is not at the core of our being. Even to hear this and to read a little bit about it and think about it is encouraging. Because I think the despair we experience when things go wrong, no wonder we want to kill ourselves because we can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. We really believe this is who I am. I'm a disaster. I'm a mess. I'm useless. I'm no good. Or somebody else is. This is the tragedy of the irony of ego. These are the voices. And this is the thing, they are in their nature, there's two main characteristics these unhappy ones have. The first one's evidence, and term, just they're deeply disturbing. Well, it's evident. You don't go, oh, it's jealousy, so it's, oh, just great. They're deeply painful. It's so evident, you know, it's a no-brainer. But the other characteristic, this is the part to see initially. This is a crucial thing that's unique to the Buddhist psychological model. they are delusions. They cause us to be delusional. And I see in many other languages, when I get translated, there's never a decent word for this, so they make it these ridiculous religious words, you know. But it's such a simple term in English, it's bullseye. You know very well if someone says you're delusional, you're not in touch with reality. And this is so exactly what Buddha is saying. In other words, the extent to which I'm caught up in anger is the extent to which I'm not in touch with reality. But what all these illusions do, the very particular way they function, these conceptual stories in here, remember the conceptual stories, these opinions, these viewpoints? These are distorted viewpoints. They distort, they exaggerate, they cause us to not be seeing the object clearly. And I think it's evident. The flip side of anger is internalized, what's called guilt, self-hate, depression. Look how it's distorted. When you're depressed, you think you're the worst creep on the planet. Everything looks revolting. And we believe it. And no matter what anybody tells us, we believe it's true. So we not only are these stories liars, they're so habitual. Because they're so habitual, we believe them. And they even impact upon the way the world appears to us. As Mother Earth puts it, the way the external world, or even including ourselves, appears back to us is, I'll use my word, through the lens of whatever's happening in my mind. It's somehow evident when we point it out like this, but we don't join the dots, we don't think this way. The habit of these thoughts is so strong, or the stronger the habit is, the more we believe this is who I am, the more we never question these thoughts because they're so deep at the level of assumption, and the more they run our lives and the more they cause suffering. That's the first category, the neurotic ones. And those opinions, those viewpoints, those opinions about things, I'm such a creep. He is a monster. That's a pretty cup. They're all imbued with this component of being of delusion. They're liars. They're misconceptions. They are not a valid assessment of something. The second category, the positive states. Cute, simple word. Compassion, kindness, empathy, intelligence. All of these are, at a relative level, I don't want to get too technical here, they are valid. They are, if, you know, if I'm having a conversation with my grandmother used to forget names, and I say, oh, I won't forget names. She said, yes, you will. I do. So, if I've had a conversation with Kathy, this is a cute example, but see the point. We're being friendly to each other. You can see by our body language from 50 metres away. Oh, Kathy and I have been having fun. Look at them laughing at each other's jokes. Friendly, empathetic, sympathising with my cancer. I sympathise with her, me ache, you know. We're listening to each other. Think about it. You could say, oh, look at that, Kathy, you're in it. There's love prevailing. Love is a positive state, under a positive heading. It's bare bones definition is start with a thought that can grow into affection. The thought that Kathy be happy, may she be happy. I delight in her happiness. That's called love. Very simple. And you grow it. Compassion, everything with their suffering. So you can say, oh, look at Romina and Kathy being loving and compassionate to each other. You just say, look at Romina and Kathy having fun. But it's clear that virtue is prevailing. Positive qualities are prevailing. Positive states of mind. Positive interpretations. I've seen Kathy, I smile at her, I think, oh, I like a new hairstyle. You know, so is that. And she's being friendly to me. But look what happens when suddenly I say a wrong word, and then she gets offended, isn't it? Look what happens. The we that felt before, the sense of interdependence, is being cut in half. And now there's poor self-pity me, and her poor self-pity her over there. You did that to me. No, I didn't. You did that to me. And now misery. What's prevailing now? Attachment, anger, fear, jealousy, and other rubbish. We kind of so know this that we take it for granted, we don't question it. This is the stuff that Buddhism deals with, and we have to deal with. This has been your own purpose. There's much more subtle than this, but this is the fundamental one. The positive states are valid, reasonable, are the source of my own happiness, and the source of my capacity to be useful in the world, because I'm in touch with reality to some degree. Put two and two together, see other people's experiences, I can see past my own nose. But I'm overwhelmed by anger, depression, anxiety, fear. That's why you don't have to feel guilty seeing these things. It should break our hearts when we see these things, because this is why I'm suffering. So why is it not easy for us to see this? Because we both seem kind of fairly reasonable. There's various things conspiring against us. The third category of states of mind. They're called neutral. There's positive, negative, neutral. And they've got a very specific use in Buddhism. don't hear it in a moralistic way than we hear it. That's why in modern psychology we never use terms like this, because we're afraid of judging people. That's not the issue here. It's much more subtle. Neutral really is referring to what I like to refer to as the mechanics of our mind. The ability to think things through. The ability to, you know, to concentrate. Like the capacity to concentrate, to remember things, to assess things. It's not, they're not virtuous in their character, and they're not neurotic in their character. They're like the mechanics. So whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need good concentration, don't you? Whether you, you know, there's a state of mind called mindfulness, which is grossly misinterpreted in the West. It's really a word that we use to refer to the capacity to remember what you're doing moment by moment. So we know you need that to make a cake. If you forgot whether you put the eggs in or the flour, you won't succeed. If I forget where I'm going halfway down to the door, I haven't got good mindfulness. But we think of it as a holy thing. Ah, be mindful, Romina. Like a big threat, you know, like a big stick when you use it as revolting. It's merely the capacity to not forget what you're doing moment by moment. As I was open, says, thieves need mindfulness. I remember one person in America left the teaching. She thought I was insulting the class in meditation. You don't understand what I'm saying, basically. So there's all those mechanics, and if they're not working, you'll be a disaster, whatever you do, whether it's killing or helping. But the first two are the ones you have to look into. And these third laws, they're developed brilliantly in concentration meditation. You get good concentration, you get good attention, good intention, good this, good that. That's all that enable us to do better things, enable us to know our minds better, enable us to make better cakes, whatever. But the one we want to get involved in, become familiar with, is all with this super emotion in there, all mixed together like the weeds and the flowers and the herbs and the veggies, all entangled. We can't tell one bit from another. So what are the things that are conspiring against us doing this seemingly simple job of lessening the neurosis and growing the goodness? There's lots of reasons why this is hard. Well, the first one, with respect, is the instinctive view we all have that's reinforced in our psychology and in our neuroscience, and that's not being fundamentalist or religious and putting them down. Please hear my point. Please, I really want you to hear carefully what I'm saying. The actual model we use in psychology and in our science is that mummy and daddy created Robina, isn't it? Made me. So that means that one of the first places we look for why Robina's angry is to see if mummy and daddy were angry. If I do maniac things, the first place we look is if mummy and daddy did something to me that caused me to do maniac things. Then we look into what the nuns did to me at school, and my sisters did to me, and then later on what my boyfriend did to me. So we look naturally in the West, naturally, because of our model of explanation of the universe, because we believe I'm a product of an external event only, so we look back into the event, into the past, like looking for a needle in a haystack. For, oh, there's the reason when Robina began to get angry. There's where she starts to not trust her boyfriend. That's fine, Buddha says. That's like looking at the soil, the weather, the amount of rain, and all the conditions for the main reason why you get a rose. They're crucial. They're external, but they're secondary. The crucial, central cause of the rose is the seed. So they all have to work together, in the right conditions, together, to produce a decent rose. So to get a moment of suffering, or a moment of happiness, all of these conditions come together. The Buddha's emphasis, his expertise, is on understanding the mind and the past karma, that informs the mind and our experiences now. So he too looks into the past. If you want to get the big picture and look into why my boyfriend just gave me $1 million, if you want to understand how come I get $1 million, or if he steals you $1 million, the logic is the same. Botany refers to weeds and herbs, not just to the herbs, not just to the weeds. Then we have to look into the past karma. So he looks into the past too, but we look into the past, but other people's past. But the Buddha is very direct in looking into our mind itself, right here. So fine to look into your past. Fine to remember what mummy and daddy did. It's nothing wrong with that. It's necessary to look at your chemicals in your DNA, because they all do play a role. There's no question. Everything's very interdependent. But the central thing is to get to look into the mind. That's Buddha's expertise. So see what that means. So, okay, that's the first obstacle. And not only just that, but instinctively, especially when something goes wrong, instinctively, why are you unhappy, Rebecca? Kathy was mean to me. I don't say, oh, you know, I've got anger and I've got out of control. We might say that sometimes. That's fantastic. At least we're recognising that. But the first thing we would say, and my memory of the experience is Kathy's mean words. It's like daggers in my heart, isn't it? Why are you happy to be? Oh, Kathy was so kind. She packed my lunch and drove me home, you know. Little baby things. So it's proving that we believe, technically, that my happiness is a result of Kathy's action and my suffering is a result of Kathy's action. Forget mummy, daddy, everything else. But that's our general philosophy. It's default assumption, deep in our bones. It doesn't mean, so the Buddha's not arguing that her role, that she doesn't play a role. Of course she does, it's crucial. But all he's saying is, the main player, the main cause is here. The main cause is here. The main cause is here. And that's something I have to come familiar with. Doesn't mean I can't change the I must fix the garden, yeah, a little bit longer. Can you keep it for a while? This is really very important because it's shocking to hear it. It's not what we're used to thinking. So we're going to really give some careful thought because it's not a contradiction. It's just an adding a crucial extra piece to it. And this is why the Buddha is saying basically, if you can change something, please change it. If you can move the house away so the sun comes and shines while your rose, great, go do it. But what if you can't? You've got to adjust your conditions. Got to adjust something, you've got to change. You don't just stamp and shout and yell at the next door neighbors, the house won't move. You've got to find a way, someone else to put your rose, or accept that that's the condition you've got, and learn to be happy with it. What to do, if you can change it, great. So it's the same with our life. But because we blame the outside, then what does that arise? That brings anger, resentment, not fair, poor me, how dare you do it to me, I don't deserve it, blah, blah, blah. And the point that Buddha's making is, he's not being moralistic. He's simply saying, Rabina, darling, you're breaking your heart talking that way. It's not going to help you. It's not going to help. There's no action point coming from that, stamping your feet because the next door in that house has rocked your sun out. Because your rose won't grow now. You've got to do something about it. What can I do about it? I remember Martin Luther King said, it's all right to find a fault. It's all right to see there's a problem. But then you say, what can I do to change? What can I do to help? Not just stamp and shout and yell and go crazy, which is what guilt and anger do. That's the difference here. It's like a practical point. What can I do? That's why I always use that example of my friends in prison. You know, like 25 years now, we're running this prison project. Cherokee in Queensland now runs it. 10 years now she's been running it. 8 years, 9 years. I ran it before that. And what moved me about that experience is dealing with these thousands of people in prison, America especially, but in Australia as well. They're all the working class, all the poor. I mean, I've never met a rich person on death row, I promise. I've never met a rich guy with a 20-year sentence for stealing, you know, a bloody video, like you had a finance thing. You just don't see it because you've got the money and the lawyers. It's just so monstrous. I mean, I get so excited about it. Mm. It's so painful to see the suffering. So for me, it's so moving dealing with these human beings. Who we gave Buddhist tools to, who's the ones you wanted. They took it so seriously because they cannot change the outside. Their backs are against the wall, you know. But they really take the Buddhist teaching seriously because they know they don't have the luxury of leaving that roommate. Some of the stories, I mean, these maniac roommates who hated them and hated Buddhism and fart and shit in their, I mean, horrible things. And they're stuck in this 8x4 room or whatever 50 meters is, tiny. Stuck with this person, 23 hours a day, some of them. You go mad, or you change your mind. And what are you changing when you change your mind? Your conceptual stories, your opinions about the thing. This is the hardest job. Because anger is an opinion. It's a viewpoint. You are evil, you're the cause of all my suffering. I'm not being mean or horrible, it's so clear, it's a conceptual story. And this is the point, the second thing that makes it unbelievably difficult, the big thing that's conspiring against us, wanting even to look into our mind to see if we can figure that, not the external. Change yourself as well, don't have a problem. Don't be sitting there like a martyr, change it if you can. But if you can't, then the hard work starts. So, this is the other thing conspiring against us. Is, and this is a tragedy, this is how we live in our world. We only notice what's going on in our mind when it has roared to the surface as a powerful emotion, which means it's affecting us. That's when our body's involved. That's why our body is what we mean by emotion. We mean, it's almost like we mean physical. That's why you only notice you're angry when the words are vomiting out the mouth and you want to kill somebody. And that's why when you only notice you're depressed, which is an internalized version, I'll describe this, when you can't get out of bed one morning when you're inert. So in other words, it's like the wheels falling off, if I use the analogy. It's like you're driving 120k down the freeway, and you suddenly discover, oh, my wheels are falling off, what'll I do? Well, it's a bit late to ask. You understand my point? It's a really good analogy. But it seems a dumb one, but it's very true, because we know that wheels don't fall off, because we have maintenance. We have methods for preventing it, not just for even working on it, but preventing it. That's Buddha's deal. That we have the ability to go more deep into the mind, beneath the emotional component, before it vomits to the surface, before Vesuvius explodes out the mouth, before you're emerging dead. Then that's the wheels falling off, and that's the main obstacle. We only notice what the hell is going on in here when that happens. Why? Because we're addicted to the outside world. We're addicted to the world and things and people and this and that, others' opinions and what's going on out there, because we believe that's the cause of happiness, that's the cause of suffering, and that's where life is. And I'm just this dumb recipient being punched and kissed, you know. And then when the dramas happen, that's the wheels falling off. And then, it's only then we decide to do something about it. In other words, if you're really, really happy and in love with your boyfriend, and someone says, go to a therapist, but what for? I'm happy. Or someone says you shouldn't meditate. Oh, but what for? I'm happy. Because we're just thinking of meditation as an alternative to a pill, isn't it? But we only want to meditate when the world's so bad we can't cope. Then you want it all to go away because you can't be in the pain. But if you learn to work with it underneath, and that's why we've got to get concentration meditation, so we can begin to pay some attention, to have a wish to pay attention to the insanity in here, and begin to become familiar with it, and start to make sense of it, and edit it, and reconfigure it, and grow slowly to become in charge of it. It takes time, it's not overnight, it's not magic, it's the hardest job we'll ever do. So one, you've got to want to do it, which means you've got to know that what goes on in here is the main player in your life, not the external. And two, you've got to learn to pay attention to it before it comes emotional. And that's the hard part. That's difficult. They're the two main things that prevent us from doing this job, you know. Now, of course, the other thing that makes it difficult, because this particular analysis of the mind is not going to be talking psychology. We look at the external, and I am this way because that happened. And she is that because of this, and she's got this disease, which means this, and they have to take a pill for this. And then we concretize that those diseases absolutely, I've got bipolar, therefore it's not my fault. Oh, I've got depression, therefore it's not my fault. That's how we characterize suffering. So the ego, something horrible, wants to find something that I've got that then gets me off the hook. It's not my fault. That's the instinct of ego. And that's hard to get past that one. Because then it's not that it's fault or not fault. What we're trying to do is locate what is in here, Buddha say, that is breaking my heart. And he says, you know, but babe, you can change it. Even that concept alone gives courage to you. And that you're not set in stone. No matter how bad it is, you can work with it. You have use tools, use friends, use support, use pills. But to help us as tools to help us do something with our own mind. That's the key job. That's the key job. So even just the concept alone that you can and you're not set in stone, that already gives the confidence. Are we hearing you? What are your questions, Leah?
I was interested earlier when you were talking.
Miss Ashley, do we not have a microphone for the questions?
Yeah. No? I don't think so.
No.
We don't. Okay.
We can try to organise one at a break.
Good idea. If we're recording it. It's just getting my answers and this frustration, you know.
Okay,
good. Go on.
Where you were talking earlier around mindset and how that is linked, how it's linked with the personality and tendencies and your experiences and all the rest, and how that then, the part that plays in karma as you rebirth and come into another lifetime, into another body. If, say, at this point right now, today, with all of us here being at the various ages that we are, if we had a mindset up until today...
Mindset. I'm trying to get this word. I didn't use that term. What do you mean by it? Sorry.
The intention that we might put into a response or an action that we're involved in.
Well, I have. Our tendencies.
Yeah.
Okay,
and what our intention is at that time,
okay,
in the interaction. So if we've had those up until this point today, and perhaps they haven't been of a positive nature.
Okay, that's me, all of us, one of us, some degree or another.
they will then have an impact into a rebirth in the next time.
Yeah, because in other words, you're seeing there are a few weeds in your garden up to now.
Yep.
If you keep growing those weeds, you'll get more weeds. It's true, you can pull them out, can't you? You can change them. That's what practice is.
That's what I was asking. So can you change?
But that's what we're talking about.
Now?
Yep. That's what I'm saying. Up until now.
Yep.
No, you can't. You can't. If the weed is there, it's grown, hasn't it?
Yes.
But you can also try to weaken it. You can't wish it didn't happen. It's too late. It's grown. You broke your leg. It's too late to say, I wish I didn't break my leg. But you learn from these mistakes. You learn from the experience. So the whole process of seeing your own mind using this model, you become very, you use the Buddhist model to describe what's there. You identify, there's the weeds, there's the craziness, there's the depression, there's the anger, there's the crazy habits. And then you buy into Buddha's model. You've got to do that. I mean, you know, stop forcing it down your throat.
Yeah.
I, in my case, deciding this is my set of my hypotheses for how my mind works. I'm using Buddha's view. So then I apply that, and I go, oh, wow, look at this, look at that. And then I start to change. I start to practice. And we'll practice it. You stop. First of all, the very first level of practicing Buddhism is about karma. Junior school level. Given that everything I think and do and say now will produce the future, implying that everything I experience now is the result of the past, yeah? And I assess the present and go, wow, look at this, people jumping in the nose, people lying to me, people stealing from me. And I go, do I like this? No. Well, then Buddha says I must have stolen, I must have lied. Conclusion, stop stealing, it's not mine. Right there. You look at the weed now, I don't like this lonely weed, it's straggling my delicate herbs. So you start stop sowing more weeds. Then you pull out the ones you've got there. So you need to stop growing them. I know weeds and things are more subtle because they come themselves and almost don't get you plant them. It's just the analogy. So your first point is you stop killing, stop lying, stop stealing, stop killing. Why? Because I'm accepting as my hypothesis that will cause me more of this future suffering and I know I don't want it. So then the next level is you've got to start dealing with the weeds that are already planted that haven't yet ripened, and that's called purification. We'll go into that. This is the most immediate level of day-to-day practice.
Thank you.
Not even looking at our mind yet. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's practice. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes, Rabina, when you're speaking about 1,000 thoughts a minute or 1,000...
A second. Even Western psychology says that. Mm-hmm. Buddha agrees. 1,000 thoughts a second.
Yeah.
You go on.
They're not conscious, most of them.
Deeply in that, deep down underneath, like this river of stuff behind, underneath, is absolutely 99.9% unconscious.
Yes.
Go on.
So would that be could that be related to when you dream? That's like an unconscious.
Okay, this is another whole way of discussing it. So especially with the more advanced, more esoteric teachings in Buddhism, in the Vajrayana, they talk about there how we've got a way of describing the mind. We've got the gross level of consciousness. It looks at day to day, the sensory and all the bit of the stuff we can deal with, the conceptual level. But then we've got subtle consciousness. And then when the grosser consciousness has ceased, which is what we know happens at sleep, the senses have ceased, isn't it? Then we have this weird experience that's called dreams. And that's very strange for most of us, we're not in control of it. That is our subtler consciousness activated. And that's where, if you're a meditator, if you've learned to harness all this energy, get this simple point of concentration and really begin to harness this energy, which doesn't exist as a technique in our ordinary world, but this is what we're capable of, then your subtle consciousness will be much more powerful, much more clear, you'll be conscious at that level, and you're clairvoyant at that level, you can see the past, you can see the future, it's more capable. Most of us have these weird, wacko experiences, we have no control over, you know. You've got your subtle consciousness. And then you've got even a more subtle level, this very subtle consciousness. And that's, they deal with all that in a whole different discussion. But that's, yeah. But that's where some people do it, have many experiences of being clairvoyant, knowing something's going to happen, remembering something that did happen. They feel embarrassed to say it in daily life, people think they're weird. But that's really not unusual. And that's the capability of your subconsciousness. Do you understand? Yes.
Thank you.
What else? Any other questions? Before we go on. Okay, let's go on. Yes, we can. Yes.
With the subtle level of consciousness, if you've practiced before, could you improve your lifetime?
Yes.
Could you experience that on the subtle level?
That's right. Yeah, of course, everything. I mean, if you look into the world, you can see kids, right? Well, these days, especially with YouTube, I always think, I can't believe what I see on YouTube sometimes. I can't believe they're not photoshopping this 3-year-old child playing Bach, you know. You can't believe your eyes, right? So there's no way in the universe we can ever explain that in ordinary Western philosophical modernism. There's no way possible. Well, like I was a little girl in America, starting at the age of 3 and 4, writing orchestral pieces for 60 pieces, you know. I mean, you can't, so all you can do, or whether it's another kid who wants to torture the animals, whether it's a positive or negative or brilliant or stupid action, it's all programming. It's all simply habits you're born with from you having done something similar before. So your question, I can hear a question what you said, but that's the word relation. Is that what you're saying? Or you're asking something from that?
I suppose it's intriguing to understand, you know, if in your subtle consciousness, if that is a stream that exists, you know, when you're awake as well as when you're asleep, but you're perhaps less aware of it.
Totally, we're totally unaware of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Go on, so then?
So that, you know, let's say somebody has practiced Dharma before.
Yes.
In a previous lifetime.
That's right.
In their subtle consciousness, that stream of practice of Dharma that they've done.
No, it's not quite like that.
No,
it's not quite like that. They don't even need to talk that way. The very fact that you're sitting here right now means you are familiar with these teachings. You would not be here if you hadn't ever heard the word Buddha before. That is simply technical. If you wouldn't be reading a book about Hitler if you didn't have some imprint in your mind. Like I remember reading about a white supremacist, a boy, a 19-year-old boy. Oh, when I read Hitler, I found I'd come home. Everything he said was true. That means already he had that programming in there from having those thoughts before. All these, how many millions of people who love Mr. Trump, they had those thoughts that he has got in their mind, and that's why they're so blissful when he expresses their thoughts. Right, that's what I'm saying. So whenever we wake up within this life, don't worry about this stuff. The fact that you're sitting here now wanting to be a better person implies you've practiced the spiritual path before. If you run to the gun club from the 2 to 5 years old, it's evident what you've done before. If you kill ants, it's evident what you've done before. If you lie and steal and kill, it's evident what you've done before. Your behaviour expresses everything you've done before. It's not just casual. It's not secret. It's not hidden. Do you see my point?
Yeah.
Forget the stuff. The gross is the right there, our behaviour is evidence. You look puzzled.
No,
am I not explaining or am I not answering what your point? Are you hearing my point though?
I am, totally.
Good, okay. That's good enough. And then at a deeper level, as we progress, then we can, you know, then when we get to the subtle level, the greatest meditators, and this sounds positive again, we can utilise that more subtle, more potent level to really do the work of unpacking and unraveling all the rubbish at the deepest level. That's the job to be done. We start where we are, the gross end. Do you understand?
Yeah.
What else, people? Nearly lunchtime already. Almost, in fact, let's go home soon. I better talk faster. Okay. What? James?
One more question. Rabina, I was just going to ask. Taking that we're all here, so we must have all practiced Dharma.
Well, be familiar with it, at least heard the word. Because a lot of people come to Buddhist teachings but don't come back. So there's something there, some seed. But if you're at the football or something, the same as with killing or virtue, it doesn't matter. Yeah, sure, go on then.
But there must be a point when that happens in a previous life for the first time.
Oh, why do you assume it's the first time, Vinny?
Hey?
Why do you assume it's the first time?
Because it's challenging and.
Why do you assume it has to be the first time?
Because,
No reason at all. It's totally logical. We all have it. We all want a first moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the Buddha would say, this is where I'm trying to be philosophical here, but I don't have to be. The Buddha would say that assumption of all many of the wrong assumptions in our mind are from the utter belief that somehow there's an absolute thing that has no cause, it's permanent and uncaused. The Buddha says that's utterly irrational. That's why it sounds insane to hear that if you see anger in your mind now, or love, you cannot ever find a first moment, logically. Because that means you're finding a first moment of love that didn't have a previous cause. And there can be nothing within the concept of cause and effect that can be a first cause. It's a contradiction in terms. That's why Buddha asserts this physical universe. The four elements are literally this universe. You can work out when this cup starts, exactly. Three minutes past three came out of the oven and is following a cup. But this came from this, which came from this, which came from this. And if you track this cup back, you'd go inexorably back to the first second of this universe. Then you've got to ask, what about before that? And as Dalai Lama said in all these conversations with the scientists, Big Bang, no problem. Just not the the first Big Bang, that's all. So as a matter of thought elements are literally the beginning of, and it's just the nature of how things are, what it says, he deserved. Minds are the same. So whereas the Christians would say God is the beginningless, God creates everything, that dualistic view does not exist in Buddhism. So it's as nothing as it sounds, but rationally it's logical. If you posit cause and effect, you can't have a thing called a first cause by definition. Because that implies it came out of nothing. And if something came out of nothing, then there's no law to anything. It's just chaos.
Oh, could you repeat that, please, Rebecca?
How much it? If we posit cause and effect as a law that runs the universe, which I think in ordinary experience we do, would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yep.
It's particularly the end, isn't it?
I'm interested in the beginning.
I know that, I understand. I'm trying to get it out there. If we do posit that as a law that runs things, if we do say that, then it is not possible for there to be the first time, the first moment. In the big picture point of view, but that implies that you've gone back and back and back in time, and that's what we all want. That's why we go to the therapist and want to find the thing that happened. There's the cause. We want to find the first thing that happened. There's the cause of all the problems. We're obsessed with that. So we want it. So if you keep going back, we are absolutely believing we're going to find the needle in the haystack. That's when it all started. That's when the anger started. That's when the jealousy started. Or that's when the world began. That's the Big Bang. Or that's when my first karma came. Or that's when the first thing I tried, I did something. But if you posit cause and effect, you go, so this moment of, okay, in general, consciousness, my capacity for cognition is existing right now. So if this capacity for cognition at this moment is the effect, it has to be the effect of a previous millisecond of that cognition. And that millisecond of cognition has to be the effect of a previous moment of cognition. Mm-hmm. And that goes in great depth when you study Buddhist philosophy, the different kinds of causes, substantial causes, direct causes, main causes, secondary causes. It's real logical, you know. So we're talking about the substantial cause of this non-cognitive process called consciousness has to have, as a previous moment, a moment of non-physical cognitive consciousness. And that moment necessarily has to have come from a previous moment of non-physical cognitive consciousness. And that has to come from a previous moment. And we want to find the first one, but you get back even 22 trillion years ago. Maybe it began then. Well, no, if that is there then, that's the effect of a previous cause. Go back another trillion years. If that is there then, it has to be the effect of a previous cause. You cannot by definition find a first one. It is nutty.
And the reason we want to find the first one is
because we've got a wrong view of the mind, Buddha says, deep in our bones, it clings to things as causeless, causeless and permanent and set in stone. It's a genuine philosophical mistake. When we start to understand emptiness, we really get to see it.
But that's what we want to blame. We want to blame the cause.
Oh, no.
So in finding the cause, that is...
No. Well, that's something different. No, wait. There's two things here. There's the actual, simple, intellectual process of realizing there can't be a first cause. Do you understand? Yeah. There's always got to be a previous one. Now take that away. Now, given that we've got this misconception that there has to be a first moment, we want to keep looking back in the past to find the thing that happened that made me this way.
Yeah.
That's the mistake we make based on this other mistake. But they're two separate mistakes.
Yeah, but we're putting our mistake on that one.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No. we believe instinctively that things began sometime.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah.
The world began. I began. Happiness began. Suffering began. Do you understand?
Yeah.
It began. When was it when it first happened? We all have that. It's a very deep one. We always want a first moment of something.
Yeah.
An absolute first moment.
Yeah.
That's a general, really deeply ingrained mistake.
Yeah.
What it says.
Yeah.
So on the basis of that mistake, then when we're blaming the outside world for my suffering, she said, when what? So when I go to my therapist, having that philosophical view of there must be a first moment, then we try to look for a needle in the haystack. What happened when Rebecca's little baby? That's when it began.
Yeah.
And then we blame it.
That's what I mean by...
I know that, but I'm saying the mistake, the philosophical is the first cause. And then having that wrong philosophy, and that comes also then brings the philosophy of me being an innocent victim who got made by somebody else. That's a different thing. And then we dump it on someone else. How dare you do that to me? It's not my fault. You made me. That's why I'm going to sue our mum.
Don't
say.
One could say the Christians would say that's the apple that was
Eve 8.
Well, all of those, whatever the stories are, but yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. There's also more nuanced stuff. Okay.
How does the ego play into that? Like, if the ego,
well, you've got to be careful how we use this word ego. It's a very casual way to use that word. And this is just a Greek word meaning I, basically. So what do you mean here?
Well, before we were saying, we were looking at the negative points that we always, our ego will
run. Our unhappy states of mind, we run to the miserable. We run to the
miserable.
We run to the unhappy.
The delusions, if the delusions come from the ego...
Well, don't say it quite like that. Just say the delusions, the neurotic interpretation of things, the anger, the hurt, the jealousy, the fears. Go on.
So, yeah. If the delusions are that,
yeah.
What the West would say, what I want to ask you is, the Western psychology, I often think, oh, ego means, you know, I think I'm fantastic, I think I'm brilliant.
Yeah.
So I just like a little bit of...
Okay, so that's another whole... Yeah, okay.
That's another...
Okay.
Yeah.
So then, I understand. So when we say, oh, God, she... What's the last one? When we say, oh, God, she's so egotistical, she's got such a big ego, we tend to mean an arrogant person, don't we? I think we mean it as that. Only just arrogance.
Yeah.
Big, loud person bossing everybody else around, you know? That's not the meaning to add in the slightest.
So sometimes we think we don't have ego because we're being nice, you know, and not being selfish, but in fact it can be...
Okay, the Buddha's view is way more nuanced, way more interesting, and there's no time to talk now, so much time, we'll do it after lunch.
Okay.
Okay? Go to the mind in more depth. Okay.
Thank you.
So, what Buddha's basically saying that our job is to change our mind, reinterpret things.
Yeah.
So right now we see that delusions are running the show, in particular attachment, and we'll go into that later. Then we see everything through the lens of attachment. And what attachment is, in a simple way of putting it here, is the nice thing that gives me what I want. So we go to lunch, and then our eyes will see all those shapes and colours, won't it? And straight away, within a millisecond, we've assessed it. There's beans, there's peanuts, and there's this, I like that, don't like that, oh, don't like that, all this butter there, all this bread there. Already without, even though we're looking all holy and nice, we're not going to be rude, you know, we're not going to leave it in the head of everybody else. We've already done our complete analysis of what's on that table, in terms of whether I like it or not. Yeah, my point, it's normal, isn't it? So let's see it from the lenses of something else. Let's see it from the lenses of kindness. This is powerful, honestly. Because the normal motivation for eating food is attachment, and we're going to go to this.
Okay.
So let's change it to kindness.
So see who prepared
it. Just think, this is our meditation. Just think that food on that table. Whether you like it or not, the secondary. But people have made it. People have put the tablecloth on. People have put the spoons out. And the plates. They didn't come out of the sky and put them on the soil of the table. People did it. And then people put the food in the plates. People cooked the food. They cut it up. Then people drove the food from the shop. And people grew the food. People sold the food. And all the creatures, even the vegetarian, think of the millions of baby creatures who got slaughtered, killing the food, being killed in the growing of the food, and the planting of the food, and the picking out of the food, and the driving of the food. So think of all those kinds of those poor centipedes you got slaughtered, just like I had a carrot. So we think how kind all these centipedes, you know, all the hard work, just like I have a meal so I don't die. How amazing. I'm going to eat this delicious food so I can be fat and healthy, so I can come back here in the afternoon and carry on talking about the problem, so I can develop my marvelous potential, so I can carry on helping others. That becomes your motivation for eating lunch now. And as Lama Zopa says, once you've said that, the bigger your stomach, the better. Okay? So now, what I want you to do is this. What's your schedule saying?
2:00 discussion.
2:00.
Discussion.
I think 2 hours is too long for lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, how about 90 minutes? But you can have discussion while you're having lunch as well. You could do that. So let's just say, come back here at 2:30. How about that? 2:30, you're right to come back?
One,
you said 2:00 discussion. No, discussion is going to be part of your break. So, what I'm getting at is this. Okay, what discussion means is this. Do it through your lunch, it doesn't matter, you can do it the whole damn time, it doesn't matter. But what it is, you get in a group, consciously, into a group of 2 or 3 people, not more, and you nut out what you've heard. Not more than what you've heard. Don't just, you know, I read a book last week, said this. It's like if you've heard a bunch of recipes this morning, you've got to discuss the recipes, basically. So analyse, think about it. What do you mean this one? What do you mean by that comma? And then write down questions that might come from it. Now, this is my option to you. I can't be a policeman, but I can suggest. You do this discussion, or you decide you don't want to talk, which means you be silent, which means you relax. It's up to you. In other words, we've got a map, so try and use it to discuss what you've heard. Have fun, enjoy things, but you get my point. That makes it really worthwhile. I always quote this. The very first time I got involved with Buddhism, my philosophy teacher, and I studied really intensively for 2 years, he would always say, 25% of what you get comes from listening, but 75% from what they in the monasteries call debate, analysis, discussion, thinking it through and then pondering it and meditating on it. So that's when you really taste it, when it really makes sense. So I'd love you to do that at any part of the 2.5 hour period. Do you understand? So we're able to come back at 2:30. Within that, you eat your lunch, you have your discussion, you can have a bit of break, you can do what you like. But that's make part of that time discussion with one or two or three of you. It makes it much more healthy rather than just having a big group and someone just goes blah, blah. And the point is to break it down and comprehend it. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by this? And not just rave on, but try and be accurate, try and be analytical and clear and open to other people. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's so delicious. Please enjoy yourself, do that. If you really don't want to do it, then please, your option is to be silent. Then you can process it yourself, and that's perfectly valid. Look at the sky, go for a walk, have a fag. Go to the fag. Okay, darling. Thank you so much. Enjoy your lunch.